Session number 3962, reel number 1.
Colonel Ham, reel 1. What was your family background, Colonel?
My family background, my father was in the army and he was serving in the 7th Hussars, and I was born in Aldershot in 1910, and the family moved to India the same year, and we went to Bangalore. And whilst there, my younger brother was born in 1912. And then the first thing that happened in our family, our mother died of smallpox in Bangalore in 1914. And whilst the Great War was on, my two sisters, the twin sisters older than me and myself, we all went off to school in 1915 to the Lawrence Memorial School, and my younger brother joined me later there in 1917 at the age of 5. And this is the background to it. Then, whilst we were at school, we lost our father. He died in Merritt, still serving with the 7th Hussars. And at the end of the First World War, we were then sent back to England in 1919, where we arrived in Dorset at my grandparents' home. The next stage of my life, I was then sent to the Duke of York School, Duke of York's Royal Military School at Dover in 1920, and I was in the school then until I was 15. This school is for the sons of soldiers in, let's say, in Dover. And at the end of my time there, I was then asked by the school bandmaster whether I would like to join his old regiment, which was the Royal Sussex Regiment. And incidentally, he was an old dukey himself. And so I said, yes, I'd like to join, and this is how I come to join the Royal Sussex in 1925. And the next stage, I went to the depot in Chichester, and then straight to Londonderry in Northern Ireland, where the 1st Battalion were stationed. And then in March 26, having enlisted for the 2nd Battalion, of the Royal Sussex Regiment, who were then stationed in Singapore, they moved to India at the beginning of 26, and this is where I joined them. We went out to India in March 26. I stayed in India then with the regiment till 1935, during which time we were stationed at Rawalpindi. And then in 1928, I came home to Kneller Hall, which was then what they call a pupil's course for 12 months. But on my return to India, we came straight up and we went to Landikotal, which is on the frontier. And that is when the trouble was on, with the Afridis. And then at the end of 1930, we then moved down to Karachi. And whilst there, life was very good from a military point of view. And we stayed there till 1935, in which time then the Italians had started to take over Abyssinia, and the British Army then moved battalions from India, and we were one of them, the Royal Sussex, the Essex Regiment, and we were then sent to Egypt, where we then moved straight to Mirza Matru. And whilst at Mirza Matru, we were the forerunners of digging trenches there, and all the bits and pieces there that were then used after us in the 1939-45 war. In March 36, we were then moved out of Mirza Matru back to Alexander, where we boarded a troop ship and set forth for Sudan, where we spent nearly a year there, and then came home in December 36. And that's how the start of the thing went, you see. How's that?
And how did you come to join the 1st Gilchrist Regiment in 1938?
While serving at home, the Colonial Office periodically send out notices that they require instructors and for the Colonial Army. And in 1938, they asked for people to go to West Africa, the Royal West African Frontier Force. And five people from my regiment, we all applied for jobs out there, and all five were accepted. And in various ways, we were all machine gunners, Treads, mortar chaps, and so forth, you see. And the next stage was we were all selected, and then we went to West Africa in June 38. Of the selection side, as you know, mostly in the service, this is all done by reports. In the army, you are reported on every year a confidential report, and it's through these that one is really selected from that side of it. And so we arrived at in West Africa in June 38, joining the Gold Coast Regiment.
Did you have any choice as to which regiment you joined?
No, we were just posted where the vacancies were. You see, I was a 3-inch mortar instructor, and they wanted an instructor in the Gold Coast Regiment, and this is why I came to be posted there in a place called Kumasi.
Did you learn anything in advance about the sort of climate and country and language that you were going to have to meet?
When we were interviewed in the Colonial Office, we were told what life was like out there, but in those days the British Army spent so many years overseas in different parts of the world that I think one had a very good background as to what you were going to. This is it, you see, it's more or less just like the Indian Army, where we had contacts when we were in India.
Did you learn a language either then or when you got there?
No, because you see, the Gold Coast had so many different tribal dialects that it was easier for us to teach them Pidgin English, whereas in Nigeria they spoke Hausa, or if you went to East Africa you had to learn Swahili. But we used to teach them Pidgin English, and they were quite good at learning and picking the language up.
How did you get out there?
Went out by boat, Elder Dempster from Liverpool. It's about 14 days sailing from Liverpool in those days, and finished up in Takoradi and over there.
Did you enjoy the voyage?
Oh yes, lovely.
What personal preparations did you make? You brought your kit with you. You brought your kit with you.
Yes, in those days when you were selected, you had to then go to a tailor in England, Hobson's, I think the name of the tailor was, and they measured you for everything, and they then put this into a uniform box, and the next thing, when you arrived on the boat, so you met up with all your kit that you had to take with you.
What accommodation did you have at Coomassie?
The accommodation was very, very good. We lived in modern bungalows, where the windows were then protected by what we call teeth wire. That's expanded metal.
Why was this?
Well, in case anybody got in, you know, to take anything. But and also, being a very warm climate, it allowed the air to circulate at night times, because you had to sleep under a mosquito net, you see. And before going to West Africa, you had a yellow fever injections and things like that because of the country.
What about messing arrangements?
The messing arrangements were quite good, because we all lived in messes. There's a sergeant's mess and an officer's mess. And this was very good. And the food one can buy in West Africa is above average anywhere. Fruit, plenty of it. And I think, as I say, from the messing side of it, it's absolute first class.
Were you able to save money when you were there?
Oh, yes. We were very well paid, actually, in those days. I mean, when you consider that we were getting £400 a year, which is £8 a week, and that in 1938 was very good money. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What about health hazards? Did you suffer from anything when you were out there?
No, we took all the precautions. We all played sport. Everybody partook of some kind, and then being with a regiment, we had enough Europeans to turn out a football team or a hockey team, and there was a lot of tennis played and golf. So you partook on all the sport there and really kept yourself fit. This was the main thing out there.
Did you mix a lot with other Europeans who were in the Gold Coast at the time, traders or colonial officials?
Yes, we used to meet traders and people out there, because they had European clubs in practically all the big towns, where everybody used to meet on say on a Saturday night. Or then they also had cinemas out there, you know, open air cinemas, where you can go and watch the films. One amusing story is that our colonel, Colonel Green, when I first arrived, his wife came out, and his wife was Winifred Schotter, the actress. And I remember going to a cinema in Accra once, and she was there sitting in the front row, and we were just watching the film, and it was her film with Tom Wall, Ralph Lins, and Winifred Schotter. And so it caused quite a lot of amusement, you see. This is part of it.
Did she stay out for very long?
Did she?
Stay out for very long.
No. She only went out for about 3 months, 3 to 4 months, you see.
Did the colonial office encourage wives to come out, or disencourage them?
Oh, yes, we had married families out there. Not many of them, but they invited wives out there. And most of the people who lived out there as traders, they also had their wives. But it was not a very good place for children. Being hot and sticky and all the things, it's they were more or less barred, I suppose, in a way. They could go out for holidays.
Mm. What did you do on leave, and how frequent was your leave when you were in Africa?
Leave, you could get local leave if you wanted it, but that was purely if you wanted to go and visit friends of yours, say in Tamale or Accra or something like that. But normally people didn't take local leave, because you were only out there for 18 month tours, and then you've got a 4.5 months leave in England at the end of an 18 month tour. So,
and people always went home, I presume.
Sorry? People A lot of the colonial officials took their leave and went down to South Africa. Some went to America. You could please yourself where you went. This was the case, you see, of taking local leave.
Would you say there were any disadvantages to African service?
Any disadvantages?
From any point of view?
No, I don't think so. I think in their selection, they selected people who were good mixers, I think, is the main thing. And to me, it was a challenge serving with the colonial army, in as much as that you got to know the people, you liked them, and the Africans, well, if they took a liking to you, they respected you and really looked up to you as somebody, you know, like a father. This was the African point of view, because don't forget, when he came to join the regiment, he was completely what we call bush, but that's not a derogatory sense. He just came in as a bush man, not knowing anything at all, and we had to teach him right from scratch everything he knew. And when you've lived cheek by jowl with these chaps for 6 months, teaching him every day and all day, they look upon you as the father. This is the way it goes.
Was it any different from teaching the Indians?
Teaching Indians? I think an Indian, he probably hasn't got the same outlook as an African. The tribal, the vast differences. India, don't forget, has been educated for quite a number of years, and an African hasn't. The chaps who came from the bush, they just live in their tribal areas, and when we used to get them before the war, they practically came just with a loincloth. I mean, this was the African, whereas an Indian, you see, he was, I think, more sophisticated in lots of ways, and he rubbed shoulders with more people who were educated and so forth.
How long did the training take? Basic training.
Basic training, the Africans came in, they went into the depot, and within 6 months, you turned out a first-class soldier.
How was this done?
This was done by... He was taught by his own... by African NCOs, and who really... and this was all done right from... you did it by numbers to start with, and he got so used to doing whatever he was taught that at the end of a month he could really march smartly and swing his arms properly, which when he first arrived he just wouldn't, you see. But this is an African. He learns very, very quickly. And to my mind, they all made first-class soldiers.
What was the sort of daily routine?
The daily routine? The daily routine, first parade would be about 6:30 in the morning. And the first parade would be what we call physical training. And during this period, there'd be inspection, see that they're all turned out properly. And then they'd do about half an hour's PT and then go off and get changed. And then probably the next stage, they'd do a bit of arms drill or a bit of marching drill. And then as the day got hotter, they would then disappear to whatever they were, if they were a signalman or a mortarman or a machine gunner, they'd go off, and this is what they specialise in, this is all part of their training. And training then went on up till 12:30. Of course, had a break in the morning, but and at 12:30, that was the finish of the day for the Africans. They then, next stage, everybody had to do an hour's fatigues. And part of that was cutting grass. and the fatigues were all, and to keep all the lines clean and all the bits and pieces, you know, all the way around, and there was a certain amount of fuel to get for the messes. This was all part of the applicant's job, and it was only fatigued for about an hour, and then he was free after that. That was his day's routine.
There was nothing else in the evening?
In the evening, they organised themselves in the lines. Some of them tried to play football, and they had their own games they played. But normally, if you were stationed, say, in Kumasi, they could go down into the town and do shopping or do anything they wanted to do. This was their life. I mean, and they had their families there with them. They married and had the children, all lived in lines. But they really enjoyed life.
Was any of this affected by any changes in the weather or whether any other routines that the regiment had?
No. When you say in the routine, once a year, we had to go down to the coast. This is when the whole battalion met, in order to do what we call manoeuvres. And by virtue of going down there, the whole battalion met up, and then we used to go along to a camp. We used to camp out there by the sea. And this was a great pleasure to the Africans, because most of them had never seen the sea before. But, and then once a year, we used to go down to Nungwa Camp, which was down on the coast. And we used to do what we call live firing. And mortars and machine guns used to go down, always go into camp together. And this was all part of their training, where you fired live ammunition.
How did these practices usually work?
How many
Were they satisfactory?
Oh, yes. They were very good. They were... having been taught the whys and wherefores, you know, of what they must do, they were really good at this, because you always had old soldiers who knew what to do first, and then all the young ones came afterwards and copied whatever they were doing. And the African NCOs are very good.
Did you feel that the young soldiers were simply copying or mimicking, or do you feel they really understood what a mortar was all about?
I think... they were, to start with, they watched and copied, but I think basically they learnt quite a lot, because I know whilst the war was on, and when they expanded, a lot of these young ones were made NCOs.
And, satisfactory.
Oh yes, very, very good. And I think you'll find that the African soldier, once you taught him what to do, he was very efficient in most of his things he did.
What about the counterpart system? How did this work?
We had every European had his opposite number in the African army. So we had a British RSM and an African RSM. We had British sergeant majors, African sergeant majors, and then there's British sergeants and African sergeants, and so forth. And this was rather interesting, because when the battalion paraded as a whole, and there was what we call the British RSM's parade, we all attended parade, and our job then was to go around supervising what the Africans did. And so they all turned out. But if the African sergeant major was having his parade, then there was always the British RSM looking on just to see that everything was going properly. But I must say, the way that it was organized, the army ran very efficiently.
Did you have special sessions at all where the counterparts got together and the British trained the Africans, or was it all picked up at a much earlier stage with the Africans?
I think you'll find that whenever there's a parade on and say there was no British officers present, then the British RSM, or Sergeant Major, British Company Sergeant Major, he took charge of the parade, and the African Sergeant Major also walked with him. So you had a dual command the whole time. At the end of the parade, after probably the Sergeant Major had been inspecting them, he would say to the African Sergeant Major, right, carry on, if it was arms drill or whatever went on, you see. And the whole system worked very well.
Was it true that African soldiers could be easily panicked? Or did they take easily to discipline? How would you describe them?
I think you'll find, when you say Africans panic, I can't remember any of the chaps under me panicking, because providing they were led and they knew you, whatever you did, they would do. No, I don't think they would not panic in the sense of that at all.
And did the NCOs welcome authority? Do you think they could have had more authority?
No, I think you'll find an African is like a child, and providing he's looked after and told exactly what to do and he's treated fairly, this is the main thing I want, you don't bully a chap, but if he's treated fairly and he knows exactly what he's given, good orders and so forth, you'll find he'll do exactly as you want him to do.
What sort of discipline did you have?
Disciplined, fairly strict. Because when you consider, it's a slightly different to the British Army, the discipline side of this. But you've got the odd characters who went what we call go for bush, which is really, they used to go down the town and probably get drunk. Well, when they came back, they were probably put in the guard room. This is another side, I mean, exactly the same as the British Army. And then they would come out and they'd be punished the same as the British Army. They'd go in front of the company commander, or if he couldn't try it, they'd go in front of the commanding officer. And I suppose some of them did actually finish up getting 28 days imprisonment. But these are the facts of life. But normally, the discipline was very good. As I say, if you had good NCOs and they were looked after, they looked after the men.
Did you ever have a case of a bad NCO?
Yes.
Have to deep
yes, yes.